I am not in the business of telling the future, but I have to predict that Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer DeLoz story by my friend and one of the most talented authors of his generation, Rich Cohn, deserves to ride high on the only bestseller list that really matters in the New York Times. Rich is coming to Chicago. He may be here now, but he's going to be at the bookstall in Winnetka tomorrow. This is, Rich joins me on the phone, just an astonishing book. You know I feel that way, do you not?
Yeah.
I wrote about this when you were writing the book. It's about...
Yeah.
Yeah, thank God you're going to be on. For a whole hour. It is. This has got to be. And you have a number of extraordinary books about Jews, about the Chess Brothers, about your dad, about the Bears, about the Rolling Stones, about the Cubs, about Pirates, about being a hockey parent. This had to be. I must feel, and tell me if I'm wrong, Rich, the most complicated and arduous project you've ever tackled.
Yeah, and it was the most important for me to get it right and to sort of find the right way to right approach to it, and was difficult.
I'm very curious. It involves the death of a woman and a guy who are not unlike a lot of your neighbors in Connecticut. One of the most intriguing things about the book is there's some overlap here. Their kids obviously knew your kids. You went to the same sorts of places. You knew friends in common. When you decided to cover for Airmail, this kind of extraordinary internet publication, the trial of the horrible man who killed the frail woman. Why did you do that?
Well, it's sort of, I live very close. The next town, I live in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And New Canaan's like where it's similar to the places I grew up. It's like not unlike Winnetka, where, you know, actually I'll be on Tuesday night. Or unlike Glencoe, where I'm from. And at first, it was in the New York Times presented as kind of a mystery. This woman who was in the middle of a very bad divorce dropped her five kids off at the New Canaan country school and vanished. So everybody, we're all so close up here, everybody freaked out.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to this person? And then the details started to emerge, and it turned into the biggest manhunt in the state of Connecticut, the most expensive. And her body has still never been found.
Yep.
And as I sort of got, and then I started to read the documents, look into the case, and it wasn't just that I felt close because I'm the same age, from the same basic world. Literally, I was close to her without realizing it. We had been at the same parties, in the same sort of social world, at the same time. And one of her, like, boyfriends she almost married is actually a really good friend of mine. I never put it together because she had changed her name when she got married.
Right.
And so it's very, very close to home. And you see in her life and all the decisions she made, I felt like a mirror of the lives of me and my friends, just in a worst-case nightmare scenario.
No question. The same thing, I felt the same way. I mean, I am from Chicago, but I certainly know the North Shore and have known people on the North Shore. And there's a universality to this story that I think is chilling. I mean, it may not be, you know, people growing up in Dalton may not feel the same way I do, but I certainly feel this way. When you were covering it for, I wrote about it when you were covering it for
yeah.
Airmail. I was sort of overwhelmed by the story. When did you think to yourself that there's a book here? I know that after you finished the Airmail pieces at a publisher's, were hounding you. Hey, how about a book? How about a book? How about a book?
Yeah.
Was that it, or did you think of a book while you're in the process of doing it?
Well, when I first decided to write the magazine stories, I had, like every other person who's a writer of nonfiction, to me, like, the greatest book ever was In Cold Blood, the Truman Capote book.
Yep.
And I knew that it had been written in installments. It didn't come out all in one issue. And people, by the end of that, people were standing in line at newsstands waiting for them to open to
sure.
get the next magazine.
Sure.
So I said to Airmail, which was still just starting, which has now sort of established itself, why can't I do this in installments? And I really wanted to write it like with cliffhangers and hooks and like an unfolding sort of thriller. And it got such a huge reaction that people were asking me to write a book about it, like you said. And my editor, who I work with, I said to him, what about doing this? He said, I want you to go back and go deeper, which I didn't really believe was possible. I thought I'd
because this thing,
words.
I mean, you even told me this thing was covered, understandably, in a very deep, if not garish, fashion by a number of newspapers. There must have been dozens of stories in the New York Times and local papers, even smaller papers. And you must have been terribly surprised at what was missed in those reports.
Yeah. I mean, it was on podcasts. It was a Lifetime movie.
Yeah.
It was on the front page of the New York Times. But when I went back, talking to her friends from the 90s and reading her own writing and getting into the whole playwriting world that she was trying to break in New York in the 90s where I was, I felt like what's missing from every other true crime book, in which her old boyfriend told me bothered him, was that in these stories, the victim sort of disappears.
Yeah.
And it always becomes about the killer, which I understand because the killers are usually very charismatic. If it's a psychopath,
sure.
There's no boring psychopath.
Sure.
And it's a question of evil. But when I got into her, she was so relatable and such a sympathetic figure, and I felt like I knew her so well. Like she could have been my sister or
yeah.
a cousin of mine.
Yeah.
And I sort of went in with the idea that I'm going to write In Cold Blood, but while writing and while researching, and I felt like it turned into Madame Bovary or something.
Yeah, I just...
It became about her as a person.
She breaks my heart, I must tell you, in reading the book, and I've read it twice. She's a heartbreaking, heartbreaking character. We're going to take a short commercial break in what Rich Cohn and I, in classic Rick Kogan fashion, have forgotten. All. We have not told you any of the details of this thing. We barely mentioned their names. I will have Rich do that after a short commercial break. He's going to be on the entire hour, and he's going to be at the book stall on Tuesday evening. What's the official pub date for this book, Rich? Now?
It came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that I have yet to see it on the New York Times best-selling list is one of the great mysteries of my life. Welcome back. Before I ask my friend Rich Cohn, the author of Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer Dulose story, I'm going to read one paragraph from the early pages of the book, and then you tell me that you don't want to get this book. This is what he went through. Searching the places you work and live for a secret history is unsettling. It turns the familiar world ghostly. This is a story of love and hate, money, debt, and status, but it's also about the lives of people you only think you know. There is the world we live in, but there's another world below, where a subterranean river rushes by in darkness. Once you've learned to see that world, nothing ever looks the same. The world revolves around a woman named Jennifer Farber, who grew up in extraordinarily ritzy circumstances, yes?
Yeah, her father was a very successful businessman. He ran the bonds department at J.P. Morgan into the 70s, and then he went off. Started his own like sort of business trading company, which he sold for a lot of money later. He became very rich, and her aunt was actually Liz Claiborne.
Yeah, yeah.
The designer, and her whole family was hugely successful. She grew up in Brooklyn Heights, which is a really nice place, and went to this private school that was walking distance from her house called St. Anne's, which is another sort of, if you just look up who went there, it's a list of celebrities and everybody. And her father was so protective of her that he actually had a car and driver for her.
Yeah.
He didn't want her going into the subway.
Yeah.
So people would say if they saw her sort of limo parked outside a club, she knew she was inside. And some people said this is kind of what made her vulnerable because she never dealt with bad people before.
Yeah.
She was kept away from all the really scary things and scary people. And when she met one in the guise of a friend, which was this guy she married named Fotis Doulos, who she met freshman year at Brown, and wasn't that interested in.
Right. One of the intrigues.
Brown. She wasn't that interested in him. Everybody was interested in her at Brown because she was beautiful. She was smart. She was rich. She was sort of a superstar.
Yeah.
And she went off to the NYU playwriting program, and she grouped this other group of students who became all hugely successful. HBO, Netflix, they've written all these shows and movies. And they put together a theater company, and she had this huge success. And later in her life, for various reasons, decided she forgot what her first dream was, which was to have a large family in a perfect life, like the dollhouse she had when she was a girl.
Well, didn't she I mean, talking about dreams and some much of there's so many different aspects to this amazing story that shattered dreams. Among them is when she was living alone before her marriage and before, and she was kind of a, she dated some guys, a friend of yours, but she had a baby set up, a crib, whatever you call these things. She was, she, and I think, remind me, she was in her mid-30s when she met this Greek psychopath.
Yeah, well, but you're right. She had this fantasy about kids and family, an extreme version of a thing a lot of people have. And she actually had a baby crib in her apartment. And she had a list of attributes that she would carry around of what the perfect man would have. And, you know, that goes with the dollhouse. That's a fantasy. That doesn't exist.
But she
realized in her 30s, and heading towards mid-30s, she was running out of time, and she ran into this person she'd known in college, Fotis Doulos, who was a Greek national, and he fit the bill in so many ways. And she kind of let her guard down because he was from the same world as her. He was from Greece. He was a Greek national. He went to Brown. And he was great looking, charismatic, that she very quickly started dating him, getting serious. And then she had red flags, which is, they went on 3 dates, and then she finally searched the internet for him. It turns out he's already married.
Yeah.
And when she confronts him, he has some cockamamie explanation, and he's just about to get divorced. And within 4 months of that, he's divorced. Within 4 months of his divorce, he's married to Jennifer.
Yeah.
Within a few months of that, they have twins. And then this sort of other life begins that's not the life that she had imagined.
No, and the other weird thing about it is, you know, I know a lot of people who are, you know, who play squash and who play tennis and stuff. This guy was a fanatic. You know, obviously, he was a good water skier, but I thought, what a weird twist. You're a water skiing expert, which he sort of tried to impart and impress on the kids. Do you think, this guy just seems scary to me from the get-go, Rich Cohn, from the very beginning, the being married thing, the obsessive nature, even the way he looks. And of course, like many people, I went to the internet and looked him up, and he was a very good-looking guy. They made a handsome couple. Did her dad take to him? Because he certainly spoiled this guy financially.
No, I think that her dad realized early on that this guy was a problem. But what her dad did was, this is a mistake a lot of I think can
yeah,
make.
Yeah.
Because he was such a formidable obstacle. Like, his daughter was so guarded that you'd have to be a psychopath to get by him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to be so overly aggressive and strong to get by the father that was a flaw. It was designed, the system, almost to turn up somebody who was not right. So the dad, I think, was scared about him. He had a temper. He was hyper-competitive. So you mentioned the water skiing. He was on the Greek national water ski team, and he made his kids water ski all day, into the winter.
Yeah.
And he drove them, and she thought the kids were suffering. And then when they would enter competitions, he would sort of cheat, because it was so important that they win, that he would have them, play below their known level so they could win. They called it sandbagging. That's a term I had never even heard. And I'm a sports parent. As you know, I wrote a book.
Oh, my God, sure, sure.
So I recognize it, but to see it about something that seems to me a fun summertime activity, not something to want to destroy the other guy, water skiing, really highlighted the craziness of being a sport parent. And early on, he started to clash with Jennifer's father. And there was a scene early, which is in the book, where he threw a chair at Jennifer's father.
Yeah, yeah.
And threatened to take Jennifer and disappear. And after that point, I think Jennifer's father, he was somewhat intimidated by Jennifer's father because he was a very powerful guy.
Yeah, and, sure.
But also, he sort of he was worried about his daughter, so he kind of handled this guy with tongs. And he gave him a lot of money because he knew that he set up a contracting business. He wasn't really doing it on his own. It was like a fake thing floated by his father-in-law's money. But he did it, I think, to keep Jennifer safe. And when the news broke that she died, so many friends of Jennifer's said to me, when I heard that she died, the first thing I thought is, Hillard, that's her father, Hillard must be dead. Because if Hillard had been alive, this wouldn't have happened, because Hillard would have protected her somehow.
Yeah. I liked in your book her parents, both of her father and mother, though the father would have certainly intimidated me too. I just think, she was a flawed human being. That's one of the reasons I sympathize so with her. Did you get that sense too? You probably, Richie, it's likely you met her somewhere in the course of both of your lives, isn't it?
Yes, definitely, because there were these famous New York parties where really very famous rock bands would play as just the house band, all of writers in the 90s, and I would go to those every month or two, and she was at all those. But it's all kind of a blur, you know? So we have all these people in common, so I definitely met her, and I did think, I'm sure I met her, but I did think she was flawed in that she had this dream.
Yeah.
That was the dollhouse, which is a kid's dream.
Yep.
It's a fantasy. It doesn't exist. And she spent her life chasing something that wasn't real.
Yeah.
And somebody at an event I had, this really good writer named Lily Analek, who interviewed me at this event, he said, it reminded her of Gatsby. And suddenly I saw what she meant.
Yeah, sure.
And that Gatsby sort of chasing this fantasy, which is this woman. But when he gets there, that's not who she is.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's so many different things.
You gotta, your dream comes apart and you're like left without the dream. You got to put your life back together.
Well, we will continue on with Rich Cohn after the news, author of Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer Dulose story, and talk about the murder itself and this guy, his psychopathic side erupts in a way, and he thinks of himself, I think, in the book as some kind of, you know, he's committing the perfect crime. And in some ways he did. It's very hard to convict someone of murder without a body. Rich, if you don't mind hanging on, Rich will be at the bookstall Tuesday night in Winnetka, 7 o'clock-ish, and it should be jammed. Welcome back. I'm on the phone, and thank you, Rich, for spending all this time to talk about Rich Cohn, talk about Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer Dulose story. It's one of the most captivating books I have read in as long as I can remember, and one of the amazing things, Rich, is that this is not a murder mystery. Anybody goes in, everybody knows going in that Jennifer is dead. Nevertheless, it reads like a murder mystery. It reads, the suspense was at times driving me crazy. I thought, wait a minute. You must have felt the same way when you started writing the pieces about the murder and the trial for Airmail. You must have, when people saw them, they must have called you and said, hey, Rich Cohn, do you remember me? We went to grammar school together, and I knew her. And that seems to me to be, this is not some kind of newspaper clip job. Certainly.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's all, I found, normally when you write a nonfiction book, or my experience, you know, I've read about the Bears and the Cubs, and you know what's going to happen. You don't really find anything that surprises you.
Yeah.
You fill in stuff, you get interesting stories, little details. As I was reporting this, and I'd already written 12 stories about it for Airmail, as I was reporting the book, I found things that, like, made my jaw drop.
Yeah.
I mean, things that shocked me and made everything look different. You know, and it happened at various points, and things her friends didn't know that I found out.
Yeah.
Because what she did is, when she got married, she was so compartmentalized. She moved from Manhattan, where she had this whole New York life, and then she moved up to Connecticut, and basically stopped talking to those other people. So yeah. Everything was news, and everything was new, and it was, you know, to find out about how she got herself where she was, and you feel so much of it. She made bad decisions. She had this dream that was kind of a fantasy. Yeah. But a lot of it's just bad luck, and it's made me think a lot about marriage, too. I mean, marriage is such a crazy thing because one is you don't really know what a person's really, really like until it's too late. You've already married them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other thing is you make a decision if you get married a little younger. She didn't. I got married when I was like 30. Any other decision I made when I was 30, like including the clothes I wore, I would never make again. You know what I mean?
That's yes,
like
I do.
One decision, you've got to live with it forever, one way or another.
Did you, in your research, what happened is I do want to talk to them about the murder itself because it was. It certainly was planned, and there's never been a body discovered. But did you meet or encounter anybody who liked the water skiing Greek psychopath?
I met people that had known him in college. No one wanted to go on the record about him. No one wanted to be associated with him. He's become such a reviled figure around here. I could understand, like, you know, nobody want to be in a story about John Wayne Gacy saying they're good pals with them.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
I get it. But on the other hand, you know, I would like to think, especially since he maintained his innocence right up until his own death and his suicide note, I would expect that people would come forward and speak well of him, even the people he water skied with.
Yeah.
Where they say, we'll talk about him as a water skier, because he was a great water skier, but, you know, he had this volatile temper and a competitive streak, and when he got into the divorce court, and to me, some of it's like about the whole system of divorce. It takes things that are bad and makes them worse. He got into this divorce court, and it became so important to him to win, to sort of humiliate his wife. And they actually let him at one point. He fired his attorneys, and he represented himself, and they let him do this thing that I never would believe he could do, which is he was allowed to put his estranged wife on the stand and cross-examine her in an incredibly brutal way. And he was like trying to beat a confession out of her. And seemingly what he wanted her to confess is that he was the better parent.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with the divorce. It was crazy. And I never really met anybody that I would like him. And something he said a second ago is interesting, which is it's like there's tension even though you know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And to me, even reporting this, there's certain movies. Like, there's a movie, maybe, I shouldn't even reference it because people won't remember it. But it's a movie, A Place in the Sun.
Sure.
Based on the Theodore Dreiser book.
Yep.
With Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor. It's such a beautiful movie. And every time I watch it, I sort of think, maybe this time it'll turn out different.
Yeah. Girl.
Did I just sucked up in it all over again, and the idea that things could work out.
You know, you have I've never met any of them, but I've met them through your work. Your lovely wife, who's a lawyer, and four boys, many of whom play hockey. Was this is not, I know you do most of your writing in the morning, and when you finished, and that's time that you devote to your children and your married life, was it a little difficult here? You're living in a very dark place with some very nasty people while you're writing this book. Did it affect affect you at home?
For the most part, I don't, writing about these things, I'm getting into them, but the real truth of it and the intensity of it doesn't kind of hit me till later, but there were moments when it did affect me, especially when recently, and it's at the end of the book because it just happened recently, the whole issue here, which you didn't really discuss, is Fotis Doulos had what they call a paramour, a mistress.
Right.
Who was sort of a beautiful socialite from Argentina. And after Hillard Farber died, he started to want to bring her out into the open.
Yeah.
And he wanted a situation where he lived with both women. He still got Jennifer. He still got her money and her connections. But he was with this other woman, and they were all in a house together, which is insane.
Horrifying.
Even though it's a 10,000-square-foot house.
Horrifying.
So I went down to... Yeah, there was a bunch of evidence that they found after the crime. And I'd read about it. I'd seen pictures of it. But they actually pulled it out during the trial of Michelle Traconis, the mistress. And it was like Jennifer's clothes. Mm. And one was like a bra. So covered in blood. You couldn't even recognize it. And the other was her shirt, the T-shirt, incredibly small. So you realize what a small person this was.
Yeah.
And like a 105-pound person, and a Vineyard Vines T-shirt that she was killed in that said, every day should be so good. It just like, you get the I just wanted to leave there. I felt sick seeing it.
Yeah.
And it made it all so incredibly real. And so, yeah, there was, but mostly you just feel lucky that I ended up with a good person that I like and likes me, and nobody loses their temper about everything. You know, like you just feel good for people that are not crazy,
yeah,
not psychopaths like her husband.
Well, what this book has done to me is I've literally started to look at everybody I know, like all the people who live on my floor on Bellevue. I wonder what the dark side is here. I wonder what.
Yeah.
I've been a newspaper man my whole life. I know there are dark sides out there, but it's such a, and you know, I started to think the same thing about Winnetka and Glencoe and Lake Forest and that stuff. How did she die? Go ahead, tell the story.
Okay, so. They planned her death so carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another reason why I think maybe he was actually a psychopath, because the characteristic of a psychopath is to think they're smarter than everybody else.
Absolutely.
Right. So mm-hmm. he believed he could outsmart the police, no problem. So what he did is he went to her house, where she wasn't allowed into her house as
right.
part of a restraining order
right.
in New Canaan. He went into her house and he sort of hung around her house on a date with her kids. She was very friendly to him, but he was doing this apparently to sort of leave his DNA around.
Yeah.
Okay, so if they found something, there would be an explanation. Then he had an employee who worked for him who was Polish, who drove an old beat-up pickup truck and had a shaved head. This was in a contracting business. Mm. He shaved his head. Okay, and then the following morning, he woke up in his town, which is about 50 miles north, and he took his employee's truck, changed the license plate, and he drove down to New Canaan, and he left his truck at a big park in New Canaan, and then he got out of his truck a bike that he had taken with him, which was an old-fashioned racing bike from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove from the park to her house, which is like a mile, and then what the police say is she drops her kids off at school, she hits the garage door opener, and he's lying in wait.
Yeah.
Which turns out is a lot of people's nightmare. I mean, that scenario.
Yeah.
And he kills her brutally, and it involves, we don't know exactly what happened, but he had zip-tied her.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, beat her to death, and there was so much, the reason why they were able to prove murder without a body is because there was so much blood in the garage, which he cleaned up, but which with luminol showed where the blood was, that the coroner for state of Connecticut said nobody could lose this amount of blood and survive
and live,
unless
yeah.
they were like in a hospital when it happened and they got immediate transfusion.
And the other is failing. I mean, he was basically, this is the modern age. I mean, he was on camera. There are cameras all over the place in this world. And he was, you could sort of, his movements could be kind of charted, could they not?
Right, well, he believed, because he knew that to some extent,
yeah.
and he'd done some research on that, but he believed that he had disguised himself, so he changed the license plate, so he knew that would show up on camera. He shaved his head, so he looked like the guy whose truck it was. He had a different truck, but what he didn't realize was, not only was there all the cameras around because of the state's cameras and the pub, there were also this is an incredibly rich area, one of the richest towns in America. And there were cameras, every house had security cameras.
Yep.
So the police went by and they collected the security cameras from every one of these houses and pieced it together like a puzzle, and they could see him throughout the day.
Mm.
And then there was basically, when they put it all together, there are two missing times. One in the morning after he kills her and one late in the afternoon when he's back home cleaning it up. And that's probably where he hid the body. But he made a crucial mistake, I can explain very quickly, which is he left his cell phone at home, knowing that the police would look where his cell phone was. They would see that he had never left his town, and he would have, that would be his alibi, and his paramour would say she was with him. All this happened, and he went home, and he had all this physical evidence, her shirt, her bra, all the stuff I mentioned, and he cleaned up the truck. He took that physical evidence, went back to his house, and then for some weird reason, got his phone. And he took his phone and went down into the city of Hartford, into the very bad neighborhood in Hartford, a super high crime neighborhood, and he threw the garbage out in bare, like in 15 different dumpsters,
right.
A little bit of this garbage in each dumpster.
Right.
And the police, when they looked at his camera, when they got his phone, see, what is he doing on this road? Like, he shouldn't be here.
He shouldn't be in that neighborhood.
So they called the Connecticut, and so that's a mistake. He took his phone, they called the Connecticut State Police and said, do you have any cameras in that area? They said, that area is such a high crime area, it is covered with cameras.
Yep.
So they got the footage, and it showed him in his truck with Michelle, the paramour, going from dumpster to dumpster and getting and shoving stuff in drains, shoving stuff in garbage cans. And when they went up there and searched, and they looked at the garbage. Now, the problem is, waited a couple days because it was Memorial Day weekend, so half the garbage got picked up.
Right.
So her body might have been in that garbage. Oh, the other half was still there, and in it was all the physical evidence, the zip ties, the bloody shirt, paper towels he'd used to clean up the blood, and that's really what did him in.
It's a remarkable, remarkable story. You must be so gratified by the reviews that are coming out. That New York Times review was fabulous. I can't imagine a review being anything less than fabulous. Are you surprised that no one else decided? There may indeed be someone else trying to do another nonfiction book about this. Does that surprise you?
No, because I think from the beginning, the way it is now with phones, and the media, everything is so fast.
Right.
Everything is surface.
Yep.
So this is like a different kind of thing where you go deep. You go back and you look, instead of like horizontally, vertically. You know what I mean? You go down.
I do.
People, everything, especially this kind of breaking story, it's all right on the surface, breaking news, then we move on. Nobody lingers.
Yeah.
And figures out what something means. And to me, it was a kind of a portrait of these very rich towns in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which are exactly like the towns on the North Shore of Chicago.
No question.
The towns outside of all the big cities have these kind of towns.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of life where you look at these houses and you envy these people because they have these perfect houses, but you have no idea what's really going on in those houses. And it's this idea that money can protect you. But what you learn from this story is if there's a bad person that wants to do you harm, money can't protect you. And in fact, money can make it worse because there's something to fight over and you can afford to pay lawyers in the divorce court until this guy goes crazy.
One last question before I let you go. And once again, the title of the book is Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer Dulow story. Rich Cohn is the author. And when you go to Rich's website, which is author Rich Cohn, you can get a book about his dad. You can get a book that he co-wrote with Jerry Weintraub. You can get all manner of books, all of which I've read. Can I ask you, how are the kids? Do you have any notion? I know you were really wonderful about not probing their lives or making any of this book about the kids. Do you know how the kids are? That's a tough thing to deal with.
Well, if you think about it, it's the worst legacy in the world, right?
Yeah.
The father kills their mother, then kills himself. Okay. But they, in a few ways, they got lucky. One is they have this incredibly loving grandmother.
Right.
Who has money and is taking care of them. They have this nanny who testified, who's like another parent who's given her life. This is a young person. She was at UConn when she got hired by them.
She's
given her life to become their parent. But most importantly, I know that when my own mother died, I felt like nobody in the world could understand what I was going through except my siblings.
Yeah.
And I feel like they have each other. And that's really a great thing. That's one good thing to take from this. I understand that they're doing very well. The older ones are very good athletes.
Mm.
They're going to be going to college. I know where. I'm not going to say where they're going.
Of course
they're
not.
Going to a great university, and they seem to be, you know, thriving. And one of the things I thought was, people said, you ever think they're going to read this book someday? What are they going to think? I thought, well, there's so much stuff out there about them.
Oh, God,
I imagine they'll read everything. And I hope when they get to my book, if they ever get to my book, it's a relief after all that just gore, and that it's a book about their mother as a person.
Yeah.
And not just defined by the single worst day of her life, but you get a sense of who she was and why her murder was such a terrible crime because of her as an individual. And yeah. It's weird because after all this, when I went back and reread In Cold Blood, now you think a true crime is just about, you know, CSI stuff, crime.
Right, right. Yeah, right. It's about human beings.
It paints a picture of the victims. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why you care.
It's human beings.
Like the Flutter family, you really know them. Yeah.
I'm going to let you go. I'm going to read this last paragraph here, and I hope the kids one day read the last paragraph of this really remarkable book. Jennifer, who'd been sparklingly alive to everyone who knew her, who had the wrong dream and followed it into a dark corner, who pursued that dream with an intensity so hot it burned blue, became no more than a problem for a medical examiner at the end. The cause of the manhunt, the body in the shallow grave or in the cement that is the foundation of a spec house, or at the bottom of the pond that is perfect for water skiing. If a body survives without a soul, perhaps a soul can survive without a body. That's the object of every prayer. Rich Cohn, I don't know if I'll see you on this trip. I'm afraid now to go to places like Winnetka and Glencoe, but I cannot. And I'll get in touch. I'm going to write about you, but I'm also going to get in touch with you when this book does hit the New York Times bestseller. It's a remarkable thing. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.